Hello and welcome to The Hated in the Dead with Tom Lehman. The podcast has covered many stories related to the anti-colonial struggle in Asia and Africa. And this week, we examine the experience of Mozambique. First, in extricating itself from the clutches of Portugal, and second, in attempting to build a workable, independent country. Following the Carnation Revolution in Portugal in 1974, Mozambique's national independence movement, the left-wing Frelimo, negotiated for Mozambican independence. Today's subject, Alfonso Dhlakama, quickly became dismayed at the country Frelimo sought to build. So was formed RENAMO, a conservative resistance movement to hold the line against Frelimo, with RENAMO soon adopting guerrilla tactics against the government in Maputo. Dhlakama's story, and the Mozambican civil war at large, are notable for two reasons. First is the regional and international dimension of the war. Though many refer to the conflict in Mozambique as a Cold War proxy, the reality, as you're about to hear, was much more complex. The Frelimo government courted support not just from communist powers such as East Germany, but also from Margaret Thatcher's Downing Street. This complicated picture contrasts with the more typical Cold War conflict in Angola, another former Portuguese colony. Meanwhile, Dhlakama's RENAMO had a multi-layered relationship with apartheid South Africa, which through the 70s and 80s waged a campaign of extraordinary violence across Southern Africa to hold back the tide of majority rule. The second facet of Dhlakama's story which makes him so interesting is what happened to him and RENAMO after the war came to an end. For the two sides did actually come to an agreement in the early 90s despite participating in a 15-year civil war which claimed the lives of perhaps a million people. Though Frelimo has to date never left power, RENAMO is a credible opposition party today, one of the most powerful in Africa. This partly reflects Dhlakama's ability to evolve and learn slowly over time. Is Mozambique a democracy today? Probably not. But its elites have at least accepted that they need to engage in some kind of inter-party horse trading. It's intriguing to compare this situation with the one in Tanzania, a country I covered a few weeks ago on the podcast, where one party has been in power since the 1960s, but has no close competition at all. My guest today is Alex Vines. Alex has led the Africa program at Chatham House since 2002, and his wealth of experience working on issues related to Africa is immense, having appeared on the UN panel of experts on Cote d'Ivoire and Liberia, chairing the former. He was also a UN election officer in Mozambique in 1994, and has authored many works related to the country. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to introduce Alfonso Dhlakama. Hi Alex, how are you?
I'm okay, good to speak to you.
It's very good to be talking to you as well. We are talking about Alfonso Dhlakama today. He was the longtime leader of RENAMO, the Mozambican National Resistance in English, which in effect made him the leader of the Mozambican opposition for much of his adult life. He was born in 1953. At that time, Mozambique was a Portuguese colony, or as Salazar's Portugal referred to its colonies, overseas provinces. Can you give an account of the overseas provinces at the time of Afonso Dhlakama's childhood, where they were and the role Mozambique in particular played in the colonial system?
Yeah, the Portuguese had a particular way of looking at their overseas territories. They, in fact, saw them as integral to Portugal. If you went to the central town hall square of Lourenço Marques, the capital of Mozambique in the Portuguese colonial period, now the capital of independent Mozambique, known as Maputo, you would have seen emblazoned in the Portuguese-style black and white mosaic floor, say the words emblazoned, "Aqui é Portugal," this is Portugal. And so that was the way that the Portuguese kind of saw managed their empire, that these were parts of Portugal, and that black Africans could become full Portuguese. They could be assimilados, if they became Portuguese in their names, Portuguese in their cuisine, Portuguese in their culture. So this is very different from what we would see in British colonialism in West Africa, which was indirect rule, using African structures to manage things and to just give overall steer. Very different style.
So having a Portuguese name is, of course, true of Tlacama. Afonso is a Portuguese Christian name. What sort of life would the young Tlacama have had living in Portuguese Mozambique?
Well, as you say, he was born, in fact, on New Year's Day in 1953, and he was the son of a traditional leader, Chief Mangunde. And so he would have had a more privileged experience than a lot of others. And although the Portuguese wanted to Portuguese-ize people, they also did use traditional authorities to try and help assist their control in rural areas. And so Tlacama came from a privileged background. Indeed, I think that's one of the reasons for his attraction to contest the party of government that emerged after independence for Lima.
Much of Mozambique's history and much of today's conversation is going to be overshadowed by 30 years of nearly uninterrupted conflict that Mozambique experienced from the early to mid-60s until the early 90s. That period of violence and war can be fairly neatly cut into two halves. The first was part of a wider attempt by Portugal to retain control of its African colonies. In the context of Mozambique, Portugal fought an insurgency called Frelimo, which is the incumbent party that you're referencing, the later incumbent party. Could you introduce what Frelimo was and how it came into being?
Well, Frelimo is a national liberation party. In Mozambique, there were a number of them, but Frelimo prevailed. It was it grew strong in the late 1960s. Its initial prominent leader was a gentleman called Eduardo Mondlane. He was well-educated out of a Swiss mission, worked for the UN on decolonization issues, but decided that he needed to engage directly in armed liberation against the Portuguese colonialists. And so he based himself in Dar es Salaam, the capital of Tanzania, which was independent by the late 60s. Unfortunately, he was assassinated by the Portuguese. And so the person that took over from him was a military leader of Frelimo called Samora Machel, who in 1975 became the first president of Mozambique. Samora Machel himself died in a plane crash in uncertain circumstances in the mid-1980s and was then succeeded by another gentleman called Joaquim Chissano as president. But we are really dealing with Cold War here also. And so the Portuguese did have some support, even from the United States, in terms of spare parts for aircraft, because of the importance of the islands of Azores in the Atlantic and a big American air base there. That's now closed, but during the Cold War, it was quite a strategic location, and so the Portuguese used that as leverage. Portuguese also said that they were fighting the anti-communist war, and so obviously in Cold War logic, there was some sympathy also from the West and Washington in that regard.
The colonial war sucked in enormous human and military resources from Portugal, as well as Mozambique. You also have attempts to retain control in Angola and what would later become Guinea-Bissau in West Africa by Portugal. Which of the three proved most problematic and troublesome for Portugal to continue its control over?
Well, Actually, it's West Africa, Guinea-Bissau, the liberation movement there, the PAIGC, led by Almir Cabral, was successful and basically had defeated the Portuguese colonialists and restricted them to a few locations. What that contributed to was demoralization of the Portuguese military, but also radicalization of them. And the revolution that overthrew the right-wing junta in Portugal by military officers was directly triggered, I think, by the experience in Guinea-Bissau. In Mozambique, the war was beginning in 1974 to turn in favor of Frelimo. But if you talk to Mozambican officials who were active in that period, they were still expecting another 10, 15 years of conflict with the Portuguese. So they were caught by surprise. So the official history talks about the nationalist parties of liberation prevailing there, but actually the Portuguese had the upper hand. And the war was turning, I think, in favor of the Portuguese in Angola. So we have three different stories. Defeat in Guinea-Bissau, tide beginning to turn in Mozambique, and actually the Portuguese prevailing, at least for the foreseeable future, in 1974 in Angola.
That's quite interesting you say that in relation to Mozambique, that perhaps Frelimo was caught by surprise. I mean, the Salazar regime comes to an end in 1974. Salazar was already dead. I think he died in 69. But
yeah, Kitano was the leader by that stage. Yeah.
His regime lasts a few more years and then collapses in the so-called Carnation Revolution. And Portugal begins the journey to the democratic state that it now is. And in the midst of this, it negotiates with Mozambique at the Lusaka Accords. How did the fact that Frelimo was perhaps caught by surprise by being at these negotiations influence their outcome and the country that Mozambique ultimately becomes in 1975?
Well, Frelimo was ill-prepared to take on government. And so you have a rushed interim year from after the Lusaka Accords that you mentioned until independence on the 25th of June, 1975. And you had a period where the settler population, very large numbers of it, the majority, left Mozambique before independence, which left the new state very ill-equipped with skills and the ability to manage a kind of modern state. And it was also born in a rough neighborhood. Your listeners should be aware that you had apartheid South Africa, very aggressive to any majority rule neighbor. But you also, in the late 70s, you had minority rule Rhodesia. And the Rhodesian regime also incredibly hostile to majority rule next to it. And so that rough neighborhood complicated already a difficult situation where the Portuguese had privileged the settler community with all the main jobs. And there was a very, very thin base of skilled Mozambicans to take over from running the infrastructure to providing healthcare.
And I think most of these settlers ended up leaving, didn't they?
Well, yes, in Portugal, there is the word that they use, retornados, the returned ones. And again, the historiography is would depict that the people that fled were mostly white settlers, but actually there were plenty that were mixed race and quite a few that were black Mozambicans. One of the things the Portuguese had done was use Africans, Mozambicans as auxiliaries and in the security forces. And a number of them decided there was no future in Mozambique. Likewise, Frelimo treated anybody that had collaborated with the Portuguese colonial regime as suspects and purged them from various government positions. So that also incentivized the fleeing of individuals.
If we think about our subject, Lacama, what had his own experience been of the period up until 1975? He was 22 at that point.
So as I mentioned, his father was a traditional leader. He came from a large family. He had seven other siblings. And under the Portuguese, his father and his family had a certain level of privilege. And when Frelimo came to power, one of the things that they moved against were traditional leaders because they were seen as collaborators with the Portuguese regime. There was also a strong kind of Marxist-Leninist ideology that developed around inside Frelimo. And so these were seen as reactionary and not compatible with the new society that Frelimo wanted to build in Mozambique. And so de Clama initially did work with Frelimo and had some low-level positions, but increasingly got disillusioned with the Frelimo project and was therefore ripe for recruitment to contest it.
So if you think about this transition of Frelimo from being a relatively broad-based national liberation movement in the 60s into being a governing political party with quite obvious overtones of Marxism, Leninism, de Clama becomes disillusioned with that. How common a transition was that disillusionment?
So there was plenty of enthusiasm for a new Mozambique, the excitement of independence and the end of colonialism. But Frelimo did move against people that it saw that were reactionary. Some of that was about ideology. Some of it was about settling local scores. And there was a system also of opening what were called campos de reeducação, so re-education camps. So, you know, if you wore bell-bottom jeans and you had too long hair, you could be sent for re-educating. So it's not just that you had been from a reactionary background, inverted commas, in the colonial state. There was also, when insecurity started in the country, there were also movement of people to protected villages, but there was also redesign of the rural economy, so people being moved into collective locations away from the ancestral areas. So Mozambican politics, even till this very day in the rural areas, is very localized, and people are very attracted to, or attached, should I say, to their land and their local culture. And disrupting that can very quickly engender grievance. You have deep faith systems where ancestors are embodied in trees and rocks and caves. And if you move people away from those, they can get quite upset quite quickly. And all of this, I think, filtered into why when we get to 1977, that's only a couple of years after independence, the country had a ripe pool of dissatisfied, frustrated individuals that were looking at some other way of contesting power in Mozambique.
I think the reason that one of the reasons that we're having this conversation about Mozambique today is the regional and international context of what becomes the Mozambican Civil War. There are different facets to this story today. You've already mentioned the kind of global Cold War context that Mozambique found itself in the middle of in the 60s and 70s, but there's also this regional aspect of apartheid South Africa and the white Rhodesian government looking at this new independent Mozambican state very nervously. What do you think the relationship is between those forces and local, maybe conservative dissatisfaction about Frelimo as we move into 1977 and the Civil War? How do those forces begin to line up in opposition to Frelimo?
So there had already been a small rebellion in 1976 with an armed group of a small number of gunmen in the central Mozambican province of Zambezia. But 1977 is when the Rhodesians found that they were getting Mozambicans coming across the border and volunteering in response to a radio station that they had set up that was broadcasting anti-Frelimo propaganda, Voz de Africa Livre, the voice of free Africa. And so Rhodesian intelligence thought, well, here's an opportunity. There's clearly grievance. How do we manage it? And so that's how what was then called the Mozambique National Resistance, MNR, which is today RENAMO, the main opposition party in Mozambique, was formed. And there is a Cold War similarity if you look at Nicaragua and the creation of the Contras. The roots of RENAMO as a armed guerrilla force were completely artificial, the training. But what wasn't artificial was that there were volunteers. These were not forcibly conscripted, neither were they mercenaries being paid a hefty sum to fight in Mozambique. They did have grievance for all the reasons that we have discussed at the local level politics, the frustration of losing land or status. And so they aligned with Rhodesia. They were deemed in Mozambique by Frelimo, but with the term Bendidos Amados, armed bandits, and some very visual graffiti and kind of painting on walls appeared. I was in Mozambique in the mid-80s. I saw some of this, including putting a RENAMO person through a meat grinder, for example, and using the word justiça popular, people's justice. I mean, the no due process there. Quite brutal propaganda about who these people were.
So it's not accurate simply to describe RENAMO as the brainchild of foreigners then?
No, it's a mixture. So there is one foreigner, a white Rhodesian called Ken Flower, who was the head of the Central Intelligence Office of Rhodesia, who decided, saw an opportunity of turning disgruntled Mozambicans into a force to destabilize Mozambique, independent Mozambique. Now, bear in mind that Frelimo also fulfilled the obligations of a UN Security Council resolution by closing transport corridors to Rhodesia. So they fulfilled a UN Security Council mandate, but they also provided rear base support and training facilities for Zimbabwean nationalists who used Mozambique as a launch pad to go in and attack the Rhodesian front in Rhodesia, the white minority regime. And so Mozambique literally became a frontline state embroiled in conflict directly with Rhodesia.
If you think about the engagement between Frelimo and RENAMO inside Mozambique during the late 1970s, the first few years of this civil war, RENAMO is often referred to as a guerrilla organization. It was fighting a guerrilla war against Frelimo, the Frelimo government. What's the kind of geography of this war? What's the setting of it? What kind of, just to add a bit of color to this, what kind of, you know, landscapes, weather conditions, temperatures are these people fighting in?
So the focus of the initial conflict was in central Mozambique, along something called the Beira Corridor, and up in the kind of the hills bordering Zimbabwe, the Chimanimani Hills. So it's kind of granite outcrops. There's some savanna and there's some very dense forest. So that's what we're dealing with. And the recruitment, in fact, of RENAMO was because of geographical location, central Mozambique, but also the people in that area were an offshoot of the Shona. So they speak a dialect called Ndau, which is just like the Shona, which is the one of the main languages in Zimbabwe. The difference between Shona and Ndau, from my experience, is in Shona there are certain words that you'll suddenly hear in English, which there were no local concepts for. And in Ndau, you go into Portuguese, but that's the big difference, and I've noticed listening to both. And so that obviously had the advantage, too, that the RENAMO people could pick up intelligence and understand a lot of what was happening related to kind of the the Zimbabwean guerrillas that were based in Mozambique, which were the ones linked to Mr. Mugabe, Robert Mugabe, who later became president of independent Zimbabwe. So the Zandla guerrillas were a prime objective of the Rhodesians to destabilize, although the Rhodesians at times found that RENAMO would prefer local targets related to Mozambique rather than following assiduously orders that they had been given by the Rhodesians.
Andre Matsangaisa, the first leader of RENAMO, is killed in 1979. This leaves Tlokama to become the leader of RENAMO. If you think about him as a commander, what sort of strengths did he exhibit as the leader of RENAMO?
Well, that's a good question. So Matsangaisa was also of kind of privileged background within rural Mozambique and very charismatic. And the 1979 killing of him in action was very disruptive for RENAMO. The Rhodesian military archives are not public, but they are located somewhere in Wales. And if you look into them, you do have the Rhodesians recorded all sorts of things. For example, the trainer of Tlokama, Major Dudley Coventry, described Tlokama in the mid-70s, in the late-70s, as a weak character. Another colleague in a memoir of Tlokama in the late-70s, in a memoir, described Tlokama as politically green, with a weakness for martial art films, Coca-Cola, and motorcycles. My view is that Tlokama was partly chosen for some of his flaws, yes, because the Rhodesians at the end of the day wanted to be able to, you know, command and control. And in the official RENAMO history, Tlokama immediately succeeded Matsangaisa. But the reality was that there were a number of different gun battles in different bases. And in fact, one other charismatic potential RENAMO leader was removed, possibly by the Rhodesians. So it's a complicated succession. And in the early 80s, it took quite a few years for Tlokama fully to assert his authority. We have a repeat issue, I think it is in 1983, where some highly trained Mozambican Air Force officers defect to South Africa, and the South Africans initially think that they might make better leaders. And you have a significant dispute within RENAMO, which ultimately results in the South Africans deciding to assassinate these defectors. And all of this came out through the Treaty and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa many years ago now, the detail of how that happened. But it shows the wobbliness of the early 80s for RENAMO leadership, and Tlokama in particular.
What's quite interesting is that the White Rhodesian government falls in 1980. It loses its own war against Robert Mugabe's forces. If you think about the dependence that RENAMO had on the Rhodesian government and Central Intelligence Office, this point in 1980 where the Rhodesian government leaves the stage, how much does that change RENAMO, and how much does it require a sort of increase in its own sophistication of its structures and I suppose thoughts as to how it views itself?
Yeah. So with the collapse of the Rhodesia and the emergence of independent Zimbabwe, what the Rhodesians did do was arrange with apartheid South Africa for the full transfer of the whole operation to South Africa, and then the operation was taken over by South Africa, by its Directorate of Special Tasks, to be a branch of South African destabilization. So there was more continuity than change for the first few years. The watershed moment where RENAMO started to have to consider that it needed to develop its own agency in Mozambique was after a non-aggression pact that was signed between apartheid South Africa and Mozambique in 1984, the Nkomati Accord, as it's called. And at that point, South African support for RENAMO needed to become a lot more covert rather than overt. And that started a journey which by the very late 80s, RENAMO really, and the beginning of the 90s, as peace talks really advanced, RENAMO really started to need to develop a more national political agenda. So this was a long process, but clearly the objectives of Rhodesia, but also apartheid South Africa, was command and control, and just to use RENAMO as an auxiliary for their objectives. But like any kind of surrogate force, the academic literature and research often denies the agency of the individuals and why they've gone into these sorts of alliances. And we see this develop over time. So if you read new academic research on the Mozambican Civil War, a lot more emphasis now is of what was Mozambican in it, whereas in the 80s and early 90s, it was all about South African destabilization and the role of others.
So if you think about that agency and the Mozambicans' own attempts to stamp their authority over this movement and to make it their own, what can you credit Zulukama with on a personal level for having contributed to that?
Yeah, so de Klerk was a slow learner, and we'll come back to this, because my view when I was a young man working and being in Mozambique and seeing some of the attacks that RENAMO had done was that it was a branch of South African destabilization. I was probably one of its fiercest critics of its human rights record during the Civil War, and you know, investigated for Human Rights Watch some of the locations. But, you know, at de Klerk's death 6 years ago, I did write an obituary where I reflected, you know, how he had changed over time. So he did learn. And once he had consolidated power, I think, and become less, consolidated power internally, by 1985-86, you do start to see a much stronger Mozambican side of RENAMO developing and efforts at hearts and minds campaigns. Because the reality was the South Africans had gone covert, the supplies were more erratic, and RENAMO needed to increasingly survive on its own. And so by probably 89, we see that RENAMO was having to even find weapons and ammunition by capturing them from the Mozambican government. It was no longer getting airdrops from apartheid South Africa because, well, apartheid South Africa was collapsing by that stage too, as you know. I mean, there is a former US military intelligence analyst who I think summed what happened very well. His name is Stephen Emerson. And he argues that RENAMO's military effectiveness for much of its existence was largely rooted in its Rhodesian South African patrimony, adherence to a guerrilla warfare strategy and strong command and control and a steady, secure source of war material. So that's how he, I think, correctly frames things. There was one piece of military equipment which actually quickened RENAMO's autonomy, which was a British-made frequency-hopping RACOL system. And that was both the Frelimo and its allies, the Zimbabweans, couldn't intercept what they were saying. But actually, the RENAMO learned how to also hop onto wavelengths that the South Africans were finding it difficult to follow what they're doing. And so, you know, we're talking about an era before mobile phones and satellite phones and things, but that one piece of equipment was probably more influential in RENAMO in its national operations in Mozambique and beginning to kind of carve out its own identity than anything else that they were given during the Cold War.
I was looking at some maps on YouTube of how land changes between the two sides progressed through the 80s. It seemed this could be incorrect, I don't know, but it seemed as if RENAMO's control in terms of overall land that it controlled probably hit its peak in about 86, 87. Certainly they had more by that stage than they had in, say, 1981, 82. Was there a kind of rural-urban divide between what RENAMO controlled and what Frelimo controlled?
So RENAMO, control, there were episodes in the conflict and things moved around, but RENAMO was never able to capture a big city. I mean, it did control at times district centres, but it found those difficult to administer. And the one bit of the Mozambican military that RENAMO really feared was the Mozambican Air Force, and they really struggled in dealing with that. But you're absolutely right that it was mostly a rural force, and its strength was also in deep forests, where there was such deep forest canopy that aircraft couldn't spot them, and helicopters. And so they were, large areas of Mozambique that RENAMO as a guerrilla force would then kind of retreat to and then come out and attack and irritate military convoys. And some areas RENAMO had designated for hearts and minds. And in the far further south, they designated areas in Gaza and in Nyambane provinces and around Maputo, the capital, as destruction zones. So they were never looking to hold areas there for a long period of time. The tactic was to irritate and disrupt and try and push Frelimo into negotiations. RENAMO never, during the 16-year conflict, never had the ambition of becoming a government. They always had the aim of some sort of negotiated settlement.
In terms of the support that Frelimo was receiving from outside Mozambique, could you detail what that support looked like?
So military-wise, the German Democratic Republic provided intelligence support. And indeed, for many years, the visa, the entry stamp to Mozambique, to about 5 years ago, was modeled on the DDR one. They only just had changed that now. There was Soviet support and also from a bit of support from China, so Eastern Bloc countries, and then the Nordics provided some Nordic countries some aid. But by the mid-1980s, Frelimo recognized that it wasn't getting the support from the Eastern Bloc that it had anticipated. It had applied in the early 80s to be a member of the Community of Communist States, the Economic Union, Comecon, and was rejected. And so we then see by the mid-80s a strategy of becoming more truly non-aligned developing by Frelimo. And the late Samora Machel visited Britain, had a very good relationship with Margaret Thatcher. In fact, they became good friends, paradoxically, and a successful trip to Washington to meet Ronald Reagan in 1985. And the Frelimo diplomacy was successful enough to ensure that Ronald Reagan and the and his administration did not equate RENAMO with UNITA in Angola. Hence, Mozambique was never the recipient of large-scale, significant U.S. covert aid. That was very significant difference between what was happening across the other side of Southern Africa in Angola, where UNITA, the rebel group there, became the second largest recipient of U.S. covert aid during the Cold War after the Mujahideen.
On the role that the British government played in this war, it's quite interesting. I mean, how did the rest of the Western Security Alliance view Britain's sort of cozying up to Frelimo? It's so different to the view that we have of Britain in the 80s, particularly of Thatcher as a kind of cold warrior?
I think it was welcomed. So when Samora Machel visited Washington in 1985, he was really surprised, puzzled, that the one thing that Reagan and the people around him wanted to talk to Machel about was Margaret Thatcher. And so when he returned to Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, he raised this with the British ambassador at the time. What was it about Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan? And what we've seen is, from now the history, is that Margaret Thatcher had convinced Ronald Reagan that Machel was moving to true non-alignment and that he was somebody that the Reagan administration could work with. And I know from a US official that Reagan said to their national security advisor, well, if it's good enough for Margaret, then Machel is good enough for me. He ain't a commie. So you can see the Cold War politics in this way playing through chemistry. But it was also that Mozambique had recognized that it needed to move to a non-aligned position and that it could not afford the sort of attention that the Americans were giving to Angola, which was pumping in covert aid.
I'd like to return to the Angolan element to the story in a second. To think about the dynamics of the civil war in Mozambique, both sides have been accused of quite egregious human rights abuses during the war. Could you detail some of the examples of that, the most notable, the most destructive examples of that?
Yeah. So in the south, in Gaza and in Yamban provinces, there are a number of really nasty massacres of civilians, Manjikas, Homuin. And it did result in the American State Department, well, US administration, let's say, I'm not sure it was State Department, commissioning a report by a consultant called Robert Gassoni that tried to categorize what was going on. I myself visited some of these sites of egregious human rights abuses because by that stage I was an analyst for Africa Watch, which is now Human Rights Watch. And there was no doubt that RENAMO perpetrated some very, very nasty abuses of many hundreds of people. And the gratuitous violence that became much more renowned in West Africa of cutting limbs and you know, mutilating children, we did see that in Mozambique too. People have forgotten about it. So RENAMO was very brutal in the south in the late 80s. But Frelimo was also very brutal and had a scorched earth policy and some very vicious counterinsurgency. Particularly in the province of Zambezi, there was a military leader up there for Frelimo called Lagos Ledimo that was very brutal indeed. And you can see that, in fact, pushed people into becoming even more anti-Frelimo and more pro-RENAMO. So it was a complicated war. And you also had auxiliaries being used, including one group called the Naparamas, who were claimed that their leader, Manuel Antonio, was blessed by spirits and could turn bullets into rain and so on. The Frelimo needed the help of auxiliaries in certain locations to assist it in combating RENAMO.
If you think about, we're jumping back slightly here, but it's quite interesting to consider in the sort of Frelimo history, do you think that earlier on in, say, the 70s, the Frelimo leaders would have been enthusiastic about signing up to being a kind of Soviet or Chinese client or ally? Was that something that they were inviting to begin with and then went soft on?
So they were, you know, very proud of their kind of liberation credentials and of challenging global inequality. And so there was, there was enthusiasm of seeing how a model could be developed that was built on socialist, kind of credentials. But by the 80s, it was apparent that that wasn't practical, wasn't working. The contradictions of all of this were becoming apparent. And so Mozambique had decided to become, well, Mozambique's leaders had recognized that they needed to become more pragmatic, more realistic. And, you know, Mozambique was a weak new state in a really rough neighborhood. I mean, it had dealt with Rhodesia, we discussed about this, but then it had apartheid South Africa with its destabilization and all the things that it was doing. And so Mozambique recognized that for its longer-term survival, it would need to reach accommodations. I have to say, occasionally, I think that there are some analogies of what Mozambique was going through with a big, aggressive neighbor that was regularly invading, and some of the echoes that we see today with, you know, Russia and its immediate neighbors, including Ukraine.
The other element of this is the kind of enormous geopolitical changes that engulfed the world in 1990 and 1991. South Africa, which has been backing RENAMO, obviously declares the beginning of the end of apartheid in 1990, and the Soviet Union collapses at the end of 1991. Did RENAMO and Frelimo basically decide to go to the negotiating table themselves because they'd essentially exhausted all avenues of conflict, of military conflict with one another by the early 90s? Or were they, do you think, taken to the negotiating table under the duress from the international community, who said, look, if the dynamics of global power are shifting now and you're going to have to come to some kind of agreement here?
I think it was all of this. I mean, there's not one key driver for the end of the Mozambican 16-year war. It became a hurting stalemate. So the collapse of the Soviet Union, the collapse of apartheid South Africa. In fact, neighboring Malawi, the change of the Hastings Banda regime is a contributing factor too. And then there's one other thing that really focused minds and in 1992, in the run-up to the Rome General Peace Accord, which ended this conflict, which was a devastating drought. And you do see that the conflicts are ripe for resolution in a number of places around the world for a number of reasons, including climatic ones. Basically, the drought was so devastating that neither side could really continue. And humanitarians and faith groups were able to put even more pressure on reaching agreement. And so that's why we have the timing of the October 1992 General Peace Accord in Rome, Italy, which ended this civil war. There was some skirmishes early in 93, but that was it. More or less it held after that.
So, to sort of consider that question in the context of Angola then, why did the war carry on in Angola for another 10 years where it had stopped in Mozambique?
So why there was in Angola not a hurting stalemate. You had a variety of different UN operations in Angola. In Mozambique, there was just one, UNMOS, and it deployed for 2 years, 93, 94, and then after multi-party elections in Mozambique, it pulled out. In Angola, you had a whole different number of UN operations, of which only one of them kind of succeeded, which was UNIVEM 1, which was to oversee the pulling out of Cuban troops from Angola as part of the deal for independence of Namibia. And so all sides agreed on that. That was the kind of the pathway to the end of apartheid, basically, and the winding down of the Cold War. But rebels in Angola had resources, diamonds in particular, and other things that they could draw upon. U.S. covert aid had finished by 1993. And so you had another decade of vicious civil war. At one moment, Angola had the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Some of the cities in Angola became a bit like what people might see from Gaza today. I mean, they became shells. There was really, a very ferocious civil war that occurred.
Returning to Mozambique, Renamo and Frelimo came to an agreement about roughly what power should look like in Mozambique after the war. Or at least they had decided that the way of mediating power relations was not, at least first and foremost, by killing one another. It was about negotiating. How do the two sides ultimately cooperate into the 1990s and after? What's the dynamic between them?
So I think we had the development of an elite bargaining model in Mozambique after the elections of 1994, the first ever multi-party elections in Mozambique. The problem was that in the 1999 elections, the presidential elections, it could have been that the Renamo leader, Afonso de Clama, just marginally won. But actually, the official results are he marginally lost. And that gave Frelimo, the party of government, an existential shock of its life that it could potentially lose power by the ballot box. And so Mozambican democracy got a lot more patchy after that, because one thing that Frelimo didn't want to accept is that it could ever lose. National Liberation Parties of government, be they in Angola or elsewhere in Southern Africa, believe they're the aristocracy and that they've earned the right to govern in perpetuity because of their struggle against armed struggle against colonialism. So we've then had a cycle in Mozambique of elite bargaining, of returning to targeted violence, and then a deal. And we've had a number of these, including then a final one in August 2019, an accord that was signed in two places in Mozambique, first in central Mozambique and then Maputo, which paved the way for a decentralized model where if you won the majority in a province in the legislative elections, you would have the right to appoint a governor. So that allowed the opposition for the first time to maybe win governorships. And there would be a pension scheme for the remaining hidden fighters of Renamo that had been in the bush for another 20 years. And that was 5,211 individuals who have not only now demobilized, they finally demobilized and reintegrated last year, but they are eligible to state pension, which is an innovation from Mozambique that I have seen nowhere else. There's something slightly tried in Nepal, but not so successful. And that is a watershed moment that a rebel force that's spent many years trying to overthrow a government is then eligible to a government state pension. And I think maybe now that cycle of elite bargaining through targeted violence has probably come to a close, because the Renamo people, they're middle-aged and older. They're 60s, and some of them are even their 70s. And what they want is just a dependable income to see their final days out. And so they're unlikely to be encouraged they're unlikely to respond to a call to return to arms for more elite bargaining.
So Kama died in 2018. After another 25 years of, I suppose, conducting the civil war kind of in miniature through these targeted violence, episodes of violence, to come to another settlement with Frelimo. This is a slightly sort of Hollywood question, but as the interview is about De La Calma, at least nominally, when you look back at the civil war period and afterwards, do you ultimately blame De La Calma for the very violent course that Mozambique took above everybody else? Do you think he is the kind of, I sort of hesitate to use the word, but do you think he's the villain in this story?
Yeah. So look, let's look at it this way. For 38 years, he led Renamo. That's a very long time to lead a party. So in my view, he proved to be an accomplished guerrilla leader, building up a rebel group from 76 members in 1977 to almost 20,000 in 1992. And his peacetime achievement, from what I can see, was growing RENAMO to be one of the largest oppositions and parties in Africa by 1999. But there is a flaw within his approach, which is, although he regularly claimed to be the father of democracy in Mozambique, he never allowed pluralism in RENAMO or permitted any succession planning. Hence some of the problems that RENAMO faces to this very day. It's got a weak leader now. And, you know, I've mentioned to you that De Clama originally, he was quixotic, prone to changing his mind, at times influenced by the last person he had spoken to. And in his early years, he deliberately wore glasses to look more intellectual. But he did have a impressive forensic memory, and was very knowledgeable on the Mozambican constitution and where RENAMO would have rights. And so I think he struggled because he was fundamentally a guerrilla leader. And there is this question, can warlords become democrats? You know, can they? And I've, you know, kind of, you know, I've wrestled with this question myself. But I do believe that he was a slow learner. I mean, this is someone that didn't have secondary education, but he learned over time. And so, you know, he has left Mozambique where RENAMO still is a credible opposition party, although it's troubled by leadership at the moment. And it has finally moved away from using targeted armed violence to try and extract a new elite bargain. So he had a very violent beginning. But at the end, he had, I think, recognized when he died in May 2018, he had recognized that his legacy would be political devolution and pluralism in Mozambique. That's what he, you know, that was what he had concluded that he could leave. So he, you know, his journey was a complicated one, full of contradictions and plenty of human rights abuses. But the end De Clama is very different from the early De Clama.
Yeah, it's a fascinating legacy. It's a very sort of sticky one. I just have one more question for you, if you have time. It shouldn't take more than a couple of minutes.
Yeah, go ahead.
If we bring this to the modern day, what we were talking about in relation to the 70s and 80s with Mozambique and with Angola was tied up with the Cold War, with geopolitical competition between two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, and China as a kind of third power. Many people believe that we now live in an age of similar geopolitical competition, not identical, but there are rhymes between the Cold War period and the period we live in now. Some people have gone as far to describe what we live in now as Cold War II. Do you think that Mozambique today, in an era where you still have Frelimo and RENAMO their relationship is different, but they still exist, do you think Mozambique risks becoming embroiled in contemporary geopolitical superpower rivalries? And does its experience from the 80s and the lasting legacy of it make it more susceptible to becoming embroiled in those things?
So there is an older generation that remember the history that we're talking about, and some of them were definitely educated either in Beijing or Moscow or, you know, parts of the Soviet Union, including what's now Ukraine. And there is some romanticism of that past. But the policy lesson, I think, from the Cold War for Mozambique is that they mustn't choose a side and get pigeonholed. And so Mozambican foreign policy is attempts to be friendly with most people and to not vote to abstain in UN Security Council debates. And you see this, Mozambique, for the first time in its history, is on the UN Security Council. Never been there before since it's been an independent state in 75. And they still continue that policy, even though the Security Council really does try and force you to make decisions. But the default Mozambique position since the mid-80s has been to abstain, is to be non-aligned. And so that's where Mozambique, I think, continues. But it will be more difficult as the West and other countries have a tug of war on Mozambique and where, you know, to make choices. So we'll see how it will fare. The big difference, I think, is that you don't now have a baby government that has, you know, just come into power for the first time in its history. You've got a country that has decades of independence. And the question I think that Mozambique is now grappling with is, when will there be a change of party of government? I don't think that's happening in the short term, but eventually Mozambique won't be ruled by Frelimo or will be ruled by a coalition. It can't be Frelimo in perpetuity. That's not going to happen. I think that's the big change that's taking place. And with Renamo also, there's contestation, serious contestation for leadership of that party now. The current leader, Mr. Momade, has been forced to hold a congress. And there's a debate, you know, with several other people saying that they would be better leaders of Renamo. And that's a good thing. Pluralism and debate is really important. One of the lessons, I think, on why there was a 16-year war as ferocious as it was in Mozambique, it was the lack of pluralism and debate and discussion. That was one group of people thinking that they had the vision for Mozambique, which, you know, in a country that, you know, from Maputo to the far north is like flying from Paris to Moscow. You can't get that sort of, you know, homogeneity in a country that's really an alliance of regions. You need to devolve power and reflect people's more local views. And I think that's the journey which de Klerk had concluded just before he died, was Mozambique's future. And I think, you know, I would share that.
Alex, thank you very much. That's been a great conversation. If people want to find more of your work, where can you direct them towards?
So just Google Mozambique and my name, and Chatham House has some of my recent work on elite bargaining. Thank you for talking to me.
Cheers, Alex. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to The Hated and the Dead. If you've enjoyed this podcast, follow it on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and, for good measure, leave us a review. You can also follow The Hated and the Dead on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, so you never miss new content.